Hello again. This is Renee Ford Clark for the Georgia Radio Reading Service, continuing with My Nightlife is 24/7 by Fiona Page. This is the third reading from this book, which was published in 2011 by Seascape Press. Now, if you remember the last time, Fiona is talking about the fact that when she became blind, the Americans with Disabilities Act, better known as the ADA, signed into law in 1990 by President Bush, had not come into effect. And she talks a little bit about her being grateful that it exists. And she says that she talks about the beginning of her trials. She didn't understand what she was about to go through in terms of being blind. She's had problems dialing a telephone, crying over trying to operate a tape recorder or put into new batteries. So let's continue. As you read this chapter, please understand that I am not complaining. I'm only trying to give you a glimpse into my new normal a few weeks after losing my eyesight. I feel that I would not be doing the story justice if I left out the situations I describe, and I promise to be open and candid in this book. However, please understand that I cannot say for sure whether each situation would have been handled differently if the Americans with Disabilities Act had already become established law. It is my understanding that benefits resulting from the ADA are decided on a case-by-case basis. Due to some quirky rule, my leased automobile was repossessed. The teacher's group insurance policy would not allow any driver to be insured other than the teacher. They notified the leasing company of the cancellation of my policy, and my car was towed away in the middle of the night. I felt like a criminal, as though I had done the dastardly deed of making myself blind. Several years later, I settled with the leasing agency. That pretty blue Chrysler LeBaron I drove for 18 months could have cost me another $10,000, the amount I still owed, if I had not made a new friend who offered to help me negotiate with the leasing company. They accepted a final settlement amount which was within my means. I had no idea that the lease agreement or the amount due were negotiable. As they say, some things are learned the hard way. Yes, there were days when I considered staying in bed and wrapping myself in my comforter, but I knew that would bring me no real comfort. A month after losing my car, the benefits department of the Gwinnett County School District contacted me with a second dilemma. A clause in the contract stipulated that I must return to my classroom upon completion of the fellowship duties, or else I had to return the grant money. At this point, I didn't know if I would be given my old job back, since I could no longer see. The questions overwhelmed me. Would I have to return the certificate, declining the fellowship? What would the U.S. Department of Education do if I was in violation of the terms? Would I have to return the money? Would they make an exception for me? I called my Congressman Lindsey Thomas, whom I had known while growing up in South Georgia. Lindsey listened sympathetically to my plight. He told me there were others who had valid reasons for not being able to return to the same classroom the next year. He and a colleague submitted a bill to Congress to change this specific regulation. I am grateful that the terms of my contract were rewritten. My grant was intact. Thank you, Lindsey, for taking this on. I faced a third obstacle when I learned I was in danger of losing my disability insurance. The benefits director called to notify me that the grant money recently wired to my personal account would be reported to the IRS as income, even though the money was earmarked for my training and travel expenses for the speaking tour. It was a catch-22. If I accepted the grant, I would forfeit my short-term disability benefits, which were scheduled to begin soon. Let's see now. Earlier, I had the problem with my mortgage payments, and now I'd gone through repossession of my automobile. I was experiencing the crisis of possibly losing my job, and now my employer was telling me this most prestigious honor could cause me to lose my benefits. What next? As I lay in bed on a chilly December morning with the phone to my ear, I listen to the benefits director suggest that I might want to decline the fellowship. Decline it? How could I decline my incentive to live? I slammed the phone down and cried well like tears. How could they do this to me? This just is cruel. The first installment already had been wired to my checking account. $3,000, that was like a hot plate. Should I touch it? I knew I had to keep careful records. None of these funds could be used for personal expenses such as mortgage payments. Budgeting for a driver was easy enough, but who would keep the records, write the checks, and help me with bookings? I was trying to learn how to walk, eat, and dress. Could I accomplish anything more? I dug in and began looking for a driver. Tracy had been one of the teens in my church when my son was little. We had been close, and she was 9, but I'd lost touch with her after she married. I called to see if she could work for me. She had recently finished a degree in psychology, but hadn't started working yet. She agreed. I had my driver. Next, I was determined to feel out my employer about my job. My friend Marie was spending the week with me. We discussed what I must do. Although my body was still weak and swollen, I called Dr. Cruz, superintendent of Gwinnett County Schools, and made an appointment. While we were on the phone, I reminded him of the positive PR this award could bring to the county. I was Georgia's first recipient of the Krista McCullough Fellowship, and that had to count for something. Could they risk allowing this honor to turn sour? His response would tell me if anyone thought I could complete the tasks ahead. We agreed to meet October 1st. Marie drove me to meet with the superintendent. As we walked into the building, I turned to her and smiled. Don't worry, I'm wearing my good luck dress. That jade and white rayon two-piece dress served me well the day I was awarded American History Teacher of the Year by the Daughters of the American Revolution. The previous year, I had been first runner-up for Teacher of the Year at Duluth Middle School. I had been told I was a good teacher, no, a great teacher, by my school principals. These awards, records of accomplishment, and words of praise by principals were in my personnel file. My hope was that the school superintendent would not want to lose me. In preparing for our meeting, I'm sure Dr. Cruz was thinking about the liability of having a blind teacher in an eighth grade classroom. Returning to work would require assistance. I would need an aide. No doubt he thought of the expense for the county, but all I wanted was my job back. Having been blind for less than 3 months, I dreamed of walking to school with my new guide dog in tow. I had no idea how long it took to get such a dog, and I certainly didn't know how much adjustment was involved or how long it would take. As I stepped into his office, I thought of my priorities. I was afraid of losing my livelihood, but keeping the grant had to be my primary focus. Trying to display confidence, I reached out to shake my boss's hand. He found it, and following a warm greeting, I reminded him of the time he had called me for assistance with a speech. He was looking out for a Br'er Rabbit story about being resourceful. At the time, I was surprised that he knew I was the storytelling teacher for his school system. We chuckled, then I jumped right in to discuss going back to work. I was prepared for some confrontation, but he offered none. Instead, he was kind, diplomatic, and, no doubt, sensitive to a teacher who had just lost her sight and now had to deal with losing her career. He knew he wasn't going to offer me my job back, nor was he planning to offer me another position, but he could tell my jaw was set. I don't think Dr. Cruz had the heart to tell me I would be too much of a liability in an eighth-grade classroom, so he urged me to return to work slowly. He probably knew better than me how much work I was facing to rehabilitate. He commented that he admired my courage for coming to see him. He promised that he would look into the matter of my disability payments. I never heard from him again on the matter. After our meeting, I had no idea what lay ahead. I went before the benefits board to plead my case several times. Friends mentioned that I could apply for graduate school to begin earning a PhD, but I couldn't imagine learning to listen to a textbook, and I didn't want to take on more education. 2 long years would pass before I knew for sure that they would allow me to keep the benefits package. I never knew what part the superintendent played in keeping my benefits intact, but I was ever grateful that they decided not to make an issue of it. Finally, someone unofficially told me they would not bother me again. They say, never burn your bridges. I believe that's a wise statement. Several years later, Dr. Cruz had taken a position with the Southeastern Regional Education Board and contacted me about doing a storytelling program for educators. He suggested I submit a proposal to the board. His respect for my work really boosted my confidence. My resolve to hold on to the fellowship paralleled my mother's determination to remain in her childhood home in 1944. After her father died, her lawyer explained that without a last will and testament, she must bid for her home like any other person at the auction. Just come to the courthouse steps and make the first bid. She did. Standing on those steps on her 2 artificial legs and looking into the eyes of the crowd, Mama pled. Most of you know me. I have lived at 816 Highway Avenue since I was 5 years old. I took care of both of my parents there until their deaths. I would like to make the first bid. No one bid against her. Owning a home was the most precious asset most people had in the 40s. Now in the 80s, I felt that my job or ability to make a living was my only asset. My mother and I both stood bravely for the same reasons. They say never give up. For a brief moment, I became my mother that day, October 1987, asking for my job in Dr. Cruz's office and vowing never to give up the fellowship. Chapter 10. Braille Fail. In my sighted life as a young teacher, I believed people in my profession were set apart from the rest of the population. We should not use profanity, get drunk, or take God's name in vain. I believed in the fallacy of perfection. We should be role models who could do no wrong. Sitting in my first Braille class at the Center for the Visually Impaired with knots in my stomach, I felt like a kindergartner on her first day at school. The Braille teacher introduced herself as Pam. As she handed me my Braille lesson book, she told me about her education and that she had been blind since birth. She introduced me to her guide dog, Rocky, who was sitting at her feet. I was both fascinated by her ability to cope and scared of the road ahead of me. "Yes, ma'am," was all I could muster. When I touched the Brailler, I noticed the 6 keys were wide, larger than my fingers, with a short space bar between them. It had a roller above the characters, much like the old-fashioned typewriter I used in typing class in 1958. I had seen one of those Brailler machines in a story about Helen Keller entitled The Miracle Worker. It certainly wasn't sleek and modern. Pam taught me to roll the stiff paper into the machine and slide the bar over to the left to begin typing. As I was practicing my Braille, I thought about Louis Braille. Here I am using this unique invention, and the man who created it never knew how many lives he would enrich. I had read about the inventor of this system allowing blind people to read and write when I was a teacher, never imagining that one day I would be learning to use his method. Louis Braille, who became blind at an early age, used the very tool that had caused his blindness to create his revolutionary alphabet in the 19th century when he was only a teenager. He was an inspiring story of creativity resulting from a disabling condition. Here's a synopsis. At the age of 3, while playing in his father's workshop, he scratched one eye, which resulted in a blinding infection that spread to both eyes. While attending a school for blind youth, one of the first of its kind in the world, he heard a speaker describe an invention that allowed soldiers to share secret information on the battlefield without having to speak. It was a form of raised lettering made of dots and dashes, and it inspired the boy to think of a similar system that could work for blind people. using the very awl from his father's occupation of crafting saddles and harnesses from leather, young Braille developed his six-dot system that allowed recognition of letters with a single fingertip. These six dots, raised as bumps, made it possible for blind people to read by touch. When Braille died of tuberculosis at the age of 43, no Paris newspaper wrote of his death. 6 months later, the institute, where he had been a teacher himself and was greatly admired by his pupils, finally adopted his six-dot method. Soon his system of raised dots became the worldwide standard. I snapped back to hear Pam describe the six oval keys in front of me. These represent the cells or spaces arranged to form characters in Braille letters or characters in the alphabet. As I placed three fingers of both hands on the keys, I thought this was ingenious. I couldn't imagine how I could master it. My fingers strained to hit the keys correctly. To type R, I pressed the middle key with my right hand while depressing all three with my left. It was just the opposite for W. I marveled how H was the mirror image of J, F mirrored D, and I was the reflection of E. When I tried to type R, I got my left hand and my right hands mixed up and typed W instead. By the end of the day, I just wanted to go to sleep. Slow and tedious, but fascinating. I started getting the hang of it after a couple of weeks. Reading was another story. I learned that I needed to use a light, steady movement of my two index fingers across the page. At first, reading a sentence would take me as long as 10 minutes. The task of running my sore index fingers across the bumps on the stiff paper droned on. When Pam finished with her other student, I began the finger reading. "Let your fingers do the walking." I repeated this mantra to myself over and over, never having been so bored in all my life. Once I timed myself, it had taken me 30 minutes to read 5 sentences. I began to think this marvelous invention was too old-fashioned for me. Would I ever master this archaic strategy for reading? One day I heard a whoosh, whoosh sound. I asked Pam, "What are you doing?" "I'm reading a magazine." I quipped, "Wow." When I was a teacher, they wouldn't allow me to read for pleasure in the classroom. She laughed and replied, "I was just trying to break the monotony." Thinking of myself as a teacher seemed like another world. Each day I went home and plopped on the bed with my Braille book. My assignment was to read for 2 hours. That would be 4 pages. I can't tell you how stressed and frustrated I felt. Some days I wanted to beat my head against the wall and scream, "I can't do this!" Shame on you, Fiona. I realized if it hadn't been for all the people who helped me get into the CBI program, plus the Kiwanis Club members who were driving me, I wouldn't even have this opportunity. Too many people to let down. One Monday morning, as my Kiwanis volunteer helped me with my coat, he noticed my Braille book. Curious, he opened it and said, "Oh, I see it has the sentences on the left and the Braille on the right." Light bulb. That gave me an idea. All I had to do was memorize those printed words. The next day I was ready. As my driver assisted me with my coat, I asked in my sweetest Southern Belle voice, "Could you read this page to me?" He did. I clicked on the hidden tape recorder in my pocket. I could hardly wait to find my way to the school restroom. I sat on the john in the stall and listened to the recorded lesson. I was much better at memorizing than touching those blasted keys on a typewriter. Convincing myself that this was an acceptable shortcut, I practiced my memory trick. Each day that week, I tapped my way straight into the restroom as soon as I arrived in the building. I wasn't yet adept at walking with a cane, but now I was motivated by my secret task. With only 5 minutes until the bell, I hid in the stall and listened to my recorder until I had memorized the lesson for the day. When I got to class, I put my two index fingers on the Braille, poised to read. "Fiona, you're reading with such fluency," Pam commented. Pleased, I zipped through the lesson. After a few days, Pam caught on, but she didn't tell me. As soon as I arrived one morning, Pam's first words were, "The director wants to see you in his office." "Right now?" Her reply was terse. "Yes." Pam gave me directions to the elevator and told me the number of steps to the principal's office. All the way I sensed that simply walking there was punishment for something. Oh, no, Pam was on to my trick. Tapping my way to the elevator, I felt the beads of sweat popping out on my forehead. I pushed the button, listened for the door to open, and stepped inside. When I stepped off on the second floor, I ran into someone who asked, "Can I help you?" I lost count and was in the wrong room. This kind person redirected me across the hall. The director was expecting me. "Well, Fiona, what would you like to know?" I didn't know what I would like to know when he asked that question. The first thing out my mouth was, "What color is your tie?" As if I knew he had on a tie. He had no idea the color of his tie. He was blind like me. I knew his name was Scott and that he was a runner and a skier because my friend Elaine knew him, but this was not the time for chit-chat. Could I have ever been the first to cheat at Braille? I was embarrassed. Here I was, a teacher. A teacher doesn't cheat. Horrors! What would my students think? Scott and I chatted for a while, then the dreaded topic. "You do not have to take Braille if you don't want to. You can take something else, like cooking or macrame or guitar lessons." I was grateful he didn't embarrass me by telling me he knew what I had done. I agreed that Braille wasn't for everyone. "It's archaic," I said foolishly. It became apparent that Braille was a necessity one day when my son pointed out the red circles around my eyes. I had picked up my red lip liner thinking I was using an eyeliner. I had outlined my eyes in red and used the eyeliner on my lips. I needed to identify my makeup pencils. Shortly after that, I was lamenting my frustration with the owner of a store that sold aids for the blind. He called me to the back of his shop to let me in on a little secret. "Have you ever heard of Jumbo Braille?" "Nope." "I didn't think so. They don't tell anyone." Like this was a big conspiracy, he demonstrated using a Perkins Brailler and a label marking tape. This Braille was twice as large as grade 1 Braille. I could feel the bumps. We conspired. He sold me a Jumbo Brailler. Fancy that. He had just the thing for me. CBI never knew. I can now make Braille labels for just about any object. I Braille my makeup pencils and canned goods. I label food, spices, prescriptions, and office folders. You may be wondering why I would Braille file folders. I feel a sense of power when I can find my own printed matter, even if I can't read it. I created my own system of Braille by using fabric glue or puff paint to identify the colors of my clothing. For example, the letter A, one bump, is for black. The letter B, two vertical bumps, is for blue. I found that creating systems for remembering things is what works for me. Different shapes and textures and sizes represent things. Instead of having all Braille dots on my computer, I have a large Velcro square for enter and a large round bump for insert. I failed to learn to read a book in Braille. However, today I certainly respect and use Louis Braille's ingenious system in my own way. Chapter 11, Freedom of Choice. Do you remember the Footprints poem? It was the inspiration for my 6th chapter title. I've always enjoyed another ditty that goes like this. I had the blues because I had no shoes. Until upon the street, I met a man who had no feet. Like Footprints, the authorship of this one can't be proven. I believe in the importance of finding new ways to feel free and have choices. Disability is tough to manage. We can feel disabled just by getting older and unable to live on our own. We feel disabled when we make bad choices and find ourselves incarcerated. Never mind that we may have done this to ourselves. We still feel helpless and inadequate. Our limitations can become chains.
I have been asked, what do you miss the most since you lost your eyesight? I miss the freedom to make choices I could make when I could see. Freedom is so important. When I was first blind, I often was frustrated because I had so few choices. I had lost the choice to do what I wanted, when I wanted. My friends and family would say, Fiona, you are too demanding. My counselor would say, no, you are communicating to others what you need. It's a fact of life that you are dependent in some ways. You will need to learn how to let others know what you need. I read a book by an author who was blind. I agree with a lot of what she said. For example, I wish other people would understand that being disabled does not mean we want to be dependent on people all the time. What this author wished for was the freedom of choice, to be able to say, today I feel like doing it myself. Her analogy was running an errand. Maybe today, maybe tomorrow. In other words, she would do it herself on her own terms, rather than relying on the schedule of a helper, no matter how well-meaning that helper might be. One doesn't have to be blind, crippled, or mentally challenged to want the freedom to make choices. This applies to the spiritually or emotionally wounded, too. Someone who has lost a child, a job, a limb, or the ability to function easily among people needs to be able to say, I need time out, or how about a hug? I have friends who have lost loved ones or suffered mental collapse. Some even suffer in silence, unable to communicate their pain. Today I feel strong. Tomorrow I may not. Please give me the freedom to be independent today or needy tomorrow. Freedom of choice, that's what it's all about. I have a hard time explaining to my friends and family that some days I feel strong enough to walk across the room to get something I need, and other days I wish someone would do it for me. Some days I can use my cane and walk alone. Other days I appreciate hanging on to an arm. Don't all people, disabled or not, have days like this? What are friends for? I remember another saying with an anonymous origin. Pain is inevitable. Suffering is optional. I heard it quoted by a presidential candidate of the 1950s, Adlai Stevenson. My mother is a prime example of one who showed faith and courage in the face of adversity. She was told that she was the first female to walk on two prosthetic legs. I cannot imagine being 14 with two wooden legs. What's even more amazing is that she is the one who, as a teenager, made the choice to have her deformed legs amputated. In 1925, a person with a disability didn't even go to school, much less graduate with a scholarship for college. Mama hitchhiked to a nearby business school where she studied to become a legal secretary and bookkeeper. She excelled and was asked to teach the courses of her trade. She walked without crutches and often fell on rough pavement. When she was a child, she crawled or pushed herself along on the low-to-the-ground platform her father built for her as a mode of transportation while she was at school. It broke my heart when she described this to me, and I wondered if her classmates ever made fun of her. Mama made friends easily. She and her friends played tag by her jumping on one of the backs of the girl so she could feel like she was running, too. She told me all this without bitterness. I never heard Mama gripe or complain. My sister and I never thought of Mama as handicapped. She did everything other mothers did. In some ways, she did more. She sewed all our clothes, cooked delicious meals, and mopped her floors. She worked as a bookkeeper. In later years, she ran three businesses at once, our family restaurant, a sitter service for the sick, and a tax preparation business. She never let on if she felt rejection, disappointment, fear, or even the least bit weird about how funny she walked. She just smiled and she did it. I trust God with my fate was her mantra. The best part was she knew how to laugh. My mother never made me feel like she didn't have choices. In my eyes, she was capable of anything. I thought I had a good hold on my situation at Easter when I turned to my mother at dinner with all the family and announced, I have been blind for 6 months. I have had few lessons in mobility. I know I can handle being handicapped, Mama. My mother sat there for a moment. She said, Fiona, I am not handicapped. You can't miss something you never had. You have lost your eyesight. That is truly a loss and a handicap. I'll never forget that. Mama, my blessing, you are in my heart every day. When she was 85 years old, we were featured together in the book Portraits and Spirits, honoring 25 disabled Georgians. Mama was living in Garden View, an assisted living home owned by my sister, when the book was on exhibit at the 1996 Paralympic Games. Determined to attend the opening of the exhibit, Mama didn't wait for anyone else to make arrangements for her to attend. She called the airline and told them about the festivities and how she was to be honored. My mother had never called for a flight reservation, much less flown in an airplane, but she was determined. She was so excited, she picked up the phone and somehow figured out who to contact. If my mother wanted to do something, there was no stopping her. She didn't make a big deal about it. She just did it. AirTran gave her a free ticket and rolled out the red carpet. When we arrived at the airport, she showed the airport personnel how to put the heavy batteries back into her electric wheelchair, which she had been using since Daddy died 5 years earlier. This amazing woman thrilled my heart when she came to Mississippi for the Miss American Classic Woman pageant in 2005. She was not disappointed that I was first runner-up. That night I danced with my mother, leaning on her as she maneuvered her electric wheelchair. I will never forget that evening. Mama was part of every day of my life in my mind and my soul, my hero throughout childhood moments, accomplishments, disappointments, college, my traumatic surgery, and my challenging years of blindness. Before her death, she saw the growth that brought me full face into the person I am, creative, loving, demanding at times, very thankful, plus determined to be productive and to love people just as they are. She was my anchor for positive thinking, my tower of strength. Mama died on March 1, 2006. She was 94 years old. Chapter 12, Autograph Your Life with Purpose. I can relate to Mark Twain's comment that you can't depend on your eyes when your imagination is out of focus. Creativity has its downside. I have so much enthusiasm that I tend to spirit many ideas more than I'm able to juggle. Suddenly feeling tired and overwhelmed, I realize I have too many items on my plate. Staying focused is my challenge. Being purposeful is my goal. As a storyteller, I sometimes provide what's called the backstory. In this chapter, I'm going to flash forward a little bit. 3 years after the events of that tragic night which resulted in my going blind, I sat in a courtroom. The hours and days wore on with 3 weeks of grueling, boring, dry testimony. It was my life, my tragedy, and even I was bored. How could any layperson sitting on a jury of my peers understand all the medical gibberish? The lawsuit was torture for me at every level. Friends and family members attending the trial would report how they thought that day's testimony went. My skin crawled as a friend described two young women who chatted and filed their nails, oblivious to their duties as jurors. I was shocked they got away with it. I expected more from our judicial system. I also expected a just outcome and, frankly, a sum of money that would compensate me for medical mistakes that cost me my eyesight, my career, my income, my retirement, and to some extent my identity as a productive citizen. I will not provide specific names and dollar figures, but I want my readers to know that I fought for justice every American would expect in a situation like mine. Yet I did not receive it. I did receive a settlement from the manufacturer of the instrument. People told me the doctors should have been ashamed of how they protected themselves instead of me, their patient, for whom they had taken the Hippocratic oath to practice medicine ethically, to place my health above all else. Others said even the hospital had let me down because they did not have emergency plans in place. I just nodded and listened as my well-meaning friends spoke. In my heart, I knew that and all more. I knew that life is not always fair. I knew I had to be my own advocate, and in time, I knew I had to get on with my life. Years later, I see the purpose for this time in my life even clearer. My dear family doctor, the one I called Dr. Wright, said this, "Fiona, most people would rather be dead than blind. God has a plan for you. You could not have achieved it sighted, or you would still be sighted." As I listened, I agreed. Generally, the things that do us the most good we see as bad. When we have good things happen to us, we become careless, assuming life will always be good like it is now. That weakens our resolve to be on guard, to remain spiritually strong and devoted to the truth of our faith. Unless we are faced with adversity, we often don't develop good character. In Romans 5, 3, and 4, we read that we also rejoice in our sufferings, because we know that suffering produces perseverance. Perseverance produces character, and character produces hope. Dr. Wright was kind to add this encouragement. A large percentage of our society says, "If not for you, I would be okay." You did not say that, Fiona. You got on with your life. One more comment I want my readers to consider. I believe the trial I endured had an unjust outcome. But if you find yourself feeling pity for me, please stop that thought immediately and consider the trials of our Lord, which led to the innocent Lamb of God being slain on the cross. No comparison. Once the lawsuit was behind me, the dreams of what I would do when I finally had all the money I needed faded away. I didn't have all the money I needed, but I had all that God thought I needed. Of course, it would take years for me to have this level of wisdom and insight. Immediately after the trial, I was stunned. Where would I go from here? I had no financial sense. Advice came from all sides on how to invest the settlement so I could have a decent income the rest of my life. After the disappointing outcome of the case, my attorney arranged a week's vacation on his yacht in the Bahamas for Jerry and me, plus my best friends Pat and Marie. While everyone else was deep-sea fishing, I sat on the boat pondering what to do next. Maybe get married since the lawsuit was over. My life had been on hold for 3 years waiting for the legal issues to be resolved. Jerry and I had been dating for 5 years, and now we could move forward. I'd always clung to the idea he and I would get married, but now I wondered if he really wanted to live with a woman who was so needy. Someone had to drive me wherever I wanted to go, and I wanted to go places all the time. I fiercely wanted to live as normally as possible. So many questions. Jerry was overwhelmed, working full-time and keeping up with my needs. Plus, after 3 years of waiting for the ordeal of the lawsuit to end, and now the shock of losing it, I focused on the house I dreamed of having. Two things had held me together: planning a romantic fairy tale wedding and having a castle in which to share our love. I invested in a house, quietly hoping Jerry would want to be there instead of having me move into his house. It was spacious with 4 bedrooms, high ceilings, and lots of windows. I liked the open living area, even though it was difficult for me to navigate without the typical box-shaped rooms to trail the walls with my knuckles. I bought new living room furniture to bang my shins on. The sunlight shining through the house gave me a sense of being outside. Jerry, the ultra-conservative, thought it would be wiser to move in with him and invest in stocks and bonds. He probably would have married me sooner if I'd listened to him. It wasn't a practical move. My house was too big and it cost more money to furnish than I imagined. I wanted to decorate and play. I hadn't played in so long. I wanted to spend time shopping and laughing with my girlfriends, to entertain my family comfortably, and to create a business. I needed to be professionally productive, and I needed the income. Young Audiences of Atlanta was booking me into schools, and I had plenty of work. The fellowship had kept me in storytelling gigs during the 3-year discovery period of the lawsuit. Now I needed direction. I had no idea of how to build a business and no idea that being blind made it doubly hard to manage. I was facing monumental tasks and didn't even understand that. I served on the board of the Center for the Visually Impaired, and I was president of Southern Order of Storytellers. I took computer classes, learned to use Quicken accounting software, and took a comedy class. Somehow I found time for Jerry. Could there be any doubt why I was tired all the time? I was asked to be on the Tommy Norbis Center board, and SOS wanted me back on their board, but keeping up with the information was nearly impossible for me. I couldn't do the simple things that sighted people take for granted, such as writing down a phone number, being able to find where you put it, and then reading it again. Prescriptions, documents, checks, and information, including current events, were just not easily accessible to me. It seemed logical to hire someone to help me. I didn't know if I could afford a 24-hour-per-week personal assistant, but I wanted one. I didn't have a marketing or business plan. I just did it. Kathy Davis appeared in my life somehow through friends in Duluth, where I had last taught. Kathy and I agreed to start to try a speaking business for 6 months. She would have many tasks as my assistant to handle every part of my waking day, accounting, wardrobe, nails, hair, and managing a household, even though I was the only one in it. I hoped Kathy would find more opportunities for me to speak. Kathy was a young woman right out of college with a marketing degree and a lot of initiative. She had a baby girl, so it was an ideal job for her. It was up to me to give my assistant direction, and I didn't know where to begin. How do you develop contacts? I got ideas, pitched them to Kathy, and waited for her to take the ball and run with it. It didn't work. We were distracted by storytelling gigs, which continued to come my way, and my up-and-down moods. Focusing was difficult because I was fighting depression. Some days Kathy came to work to find me still in bed. I never admitted how depressed I was. My life had been a whirlwind since I first became blind. That made it easy to avoid grieving for my loss of sight. I was spent with just getting through each day as I adapted. Often I imagined how longer it took me than a sighted person to do everyday things. I finally realized if I dwelled on that, I would never get out of bed. In front of an audience, I didn't feel disabled, nor did I look it, I was told. On the stage, in the classroom, and behind a podium, I felt normal, happy, and not blind. When I wasn't there, I was tired and lost. Looking back, I see this as my denial period. I was not accepting blindness as my challenge, but instead as an inconvenience that I lived with. So many times I was given responsibility for something I had no idea how I could accomplish, yet I couldn't bring myself to tell them I was afraid I couldn't do it, so I accepted. In 1992, Carmen Deedy asked me to co-produce the Atlanta Storytelling Festival at the Atlanta History Center. I had produced the Old Christmas Festival in January of 1990 and asked Carmen to co-produce. Now it was her turn to call on me for help. Carmen suggested I be one of the storytellers. When the day of the festival arrived, I was sitting in one of the outdoor tents waiting to tell a story. I heard my colleague B.J. Abraham introducing me. Suddenly, I felt sick. I wanted to run. I couldn't run without holding on to Jean, my sighted guide. I turned to her and said, "Get me out of here, quick." She didn't know what was up, but she gave me her arm and we headed for the main building at a fast pace. I thought I would pass out before I got away from the crowd. I didn't know what was happening. When we entered the building, my legs floated out from under me. I collapsed. When I came to, my heart was thumping wildly. As my chest tightened, I felt like I was going to explode. Two volunteers who had medical experience rushed to my side and laid me on the floor of the great hall. I recognized one of them as my friend Joan. As she leaned into me, I grabbed her arm. "I'm having a heart attack," I stammered. Joan said, "No, you're having an anxiety attack, Fiona." Although she was an RN, I still didn't believe her. Even as I write this, my chest tightens as I recall how I felt that night. Remember how my superior vena cava had been patched with a piece of my heart lining? I was convinced the day would come when it would break open. "My heart's going to burst." Joan tried to comfort me. "The EMTs are on their way. You're going to be fine." The ambulance screamed as it swung in. They lifted me and whizzed off. Warm pee wet my legs and dripped down my thighs. Crying, I spoke to the EMT. "I'm dying." Somehow I recall reading that losing control of your bladder meant death. "No," she replied, but I don't know what else she said. All I could think of was I would never see my family again. My family doctor was waiting for me at the hospital. He assured me I was not dying. I was only scared, but to this day I don't know why. Was it a delayed reaction to the previous 4 years and the grueling trial? Ever since that fateful night in the ER, I had been running, running, trying to be super blind. I wanted to be as brave as my mother. I did everything the way I thought my mother would. She had been a businesswoman all her adult life. She worked with numbers, accounting, and loved it. I couldn't even balance my checkbook after becoming blind. I needed help. Time to slow down. I needed proficiency in computer skills, mobility, and taking care of my needs like cooking and paying bills. I now understand my erratic behavior was because I had no direction. The next year, Kathy left my employment for a teaching position. Having been inside so many schools with me, she decided that would be a great career for her. I was happy for her, but now I had no driver or daily assistant. God always sent me angels when I needed them. My storytelling buddies, Ann and BJ, started a consortium. We called it Atlanta Storyworks. Together, we did performances and presentations on storytelling skills. We traveled as the act Three Stories High and told Aesop's Fables and International Tales. Over the next 2 years, BJ and I performed in tandem for the National Storytelling Conference. The sad part of this story was, as artists, we were unable to discipline ourselves to be marketers. This is a thorn for many creative people. Eventually, we disbanded and pursued different paths. Alas, Atlanta Storyworks was no more, but I gained confidence as an entrepreneur and performing artist. The summer following the demise of Atlanta Storyworks, I sat at my computer, pondering what my purpose truly was to be. There were so many storytellers, I needed a niche. I remember the summer I spent with a young protege researching stories that exemplified good character. That's it. We need tales about good character. When I had lived in Oregon in the 70s, I wasn't teaching, but instead spent my time exploring creative avenues. I discovered a series of tapes by Marlo Thomas about liking yourself. At the time, her show, That Girl, was among the most popular shows on TV. She and her father, Danny Thomas, were well-respected as role models for our generation. She inspired my creativity. Thus, the program, Be Who You Are, was born, to encourage kids to be the best they could be. Heather Forrest greatly influenced my story work. She was an internationally known performing artist. Early in my career, after I became blind, she encouraged me by recommending me for performances in the Chicago area. Through her referrals, I toured the northern and central regions of Illinois. With Heather Forrest's permission, I took a story that she had brought to life from her interpretation of an Aesop fable. My version of Charlie Macaroni was birthed. The crow in the story thinks he's ugly. As the story grew with my experience of telling it to hundreds of children, I was inspired to use it as the pivot point for Be Who You Are. Eventually, the story emerged with its own personality. When I had taught elementary school, I often sang songs about being confident and liking yourself. A journey of healing was emerging. I was the one who longed to fit in, to feel pretty, not ugly. In Charlie Macaroni, the crow sees his image in the pond. Now I long to see my image. Flashing forward to explain more about how my storytelling career continued to flourish. By the early and mid-1990s, Atlanta was all abuzz about hosting the Olympic Games in 1996. This would include a series of athletic contests for people with disabilities, known as the Atlanta Paralympics. With these approaching, the director and founder of Young Audiences wrote a lovely bio to introduce me as one of their storytellers. In the fall of 1995, the Paralympics Executive Committee invited me to tell the story of their mascot, Blaze. He was 8 feet tall and fun to dance with in front of the kids. I traveled to schools in the metro Atlanta area with many Paralympic athletes. Speaking on the same platform with world-class athletes was an honor and a privilege. In 1996, I was invited to perform at the Atlanta Paralympic Games. I entertained at the evening event for the athletes and their families from around the world. Each storytelling gig told me I enjoyed speaking with the stories to back up my presentation. I pioneered the first example of presenting character traits in a creative form for Georgia students. My program about self-worth and discovering our gifts and talents was popular with students of all ages. I was asked to add an extra presentation for a special class. We talked about what it's like to be different. I pulled out of my repertoire a funny old Southern folktale with my own twist. My signature story, Billy Bowlegs, had special meaning for students with challenges. Billy Bowlegs was a wiener dog who soared even though he was disabled and couldn't run in the same way that other dogs ran. The obstacle was that he couldn't do what he loved, chase rabbits. But Billy discovered a way, meeting his challenge and overcoming it. The children loved it so much that I realized why I wanted to tell it. The story spoke to my own struggles and to my mother's inability to run and play like normal children. Billy Bowlegs had a new purpose. One particular third grader who happened to be named Billy caught the tennis ball that I threw into the audience. The teachers collectively held their breath. Billy, a visually impaired student, had a tendency to act out inappropriately. Remarkably, Billy and I connected on a different level. What a beautiful communication. Together, we demonstrated the use of Braille and sighted guide technique. I know that neither Billy nor I will ever forget that moment. Another teacher came by the second day I was telling stories at her school. She had a small group of children with special needs at the program the day before. The teacher shared, "I asked the class what they remembered the most about your performance. The boy with Asperger's syndrome, the high end of the spectrum for autism, said it's okay to be different." Words I will not soon forget. The title, Autograph Your Life with Purpose, emerged when an assistant named Cookie and I were laughing and cooling our heels in the mall. We checked out our usual places, coffee shop and dollar store. I was trying to come up with a title for my business cards. Cookie said, "Okay, let's browse the card shop for ideas." She saw a greeting card that inspired me to create the branding for my business. Autograph Your Life with Purpose. Purpose and people have been my focus. I love people, and I live for a purpose. Cookie and I worked together for several years. I still smile when I hear her quip with twisted words like mental pause. She could take a simple yo-yo and mesmerize the kids with her antics, but she did not want the spotlight. Warming up the audience was all she wanted to do as I got ready for them. Her prayers and her personality gave me energy. The storytelling in school markets continued to draw me in, but I still wanted to speak to adults. Word of mouth spread. My phone rang for speeches. People wanted to hear what happened to me. I had to have some training to get beyond the emotional ownership of the story. Joining the Georgia chapter of the National Speakers Association would be my new adventure. With sweaty palms, just like when I used to hold hands with a boy in the Royal Theater, I nervously stood up at my first meeting to introduce myself. I wanted to be just like these professionals, but how would I meet them? In a large group like this, greeting people was really tenuous. I could not discern who was talking to who and when to jump in on a conversation. My colleague Ann from Atlanta Storyworks took me to the first few NSA Georgia meetings. Ann was good at taking notes and networking with people. I attended a seminar about the business of speaking and was blown away by Gail Geary, a former attorney and teacher. I once had the erroneous notion that teachers could do anything but teach. But Gail inspired me to acknowledge my potential. I attended as many seminars as I could. Then I found a friend in NSA. Renee Godfrey made me feel accepted in the organization. He was new himself, yet he had an uncanny ability to connect with people. When I heard Renee's story of wretched poverty in Haiti and how he reached his desire for U.S. citizenship, I was overwhelmed. If he could conquer those odds, I could hurdle mine. Encouraged to join in and share my own talents, I volunteered to instruct at the Speakers Academy about using stories in public speaking. I had a business card designed with my new logo, Autograph Your Life with Purpose. My own autograph was above it. My mission was, and is, to share my personal story to encourage others to accept difficult changes in their lives. Once again, I was spurred on. Ironically, my teenage neighbor Andrew, while browsing my senior class yearbook, asked, "Did you always want to be a speaker?" I said, "No. It says here that you want to be a public speaker." "Really?" I was surprised because I didn't remember that. Must have been a whim. Recently, BJ and I were reminiscing about all the events that have taken place since my blindness. She exclaimed, "Fiona, you amaze me. You are a realist and a dreamer." "How do you mean? I see that as such a contradiction." She protested, "No, it's a compliment. It's a balance." "Me balanced?" Maybe she was right. It surprised me when my friends told me the effect I had on people. Having a mother with a physical disability who saw herself as normal made me think the same way. God let me live for His greater purpose. I like to think we grow and learn from our mistakes. Being aware of my limitations is still an uphill battle for me. What others view as impossible feats, I see as another hurdle to jump. I thank my mother for that insight. She has been the constant inspiration which spurs me on. Chapter 13. Laugh to Keep from Crying. This chapter will make you laugh, and it will make you cry. Life is like that, isn't it? It hands us some crazy circumstances, and you find that disabled people are not immune from comic moments, as well as life's troubles. So here's a series of vignettes to provide insight into my life as a blind person. Our time is up for today. I hope you can join me next time when we continue with My Nightlife is 24/7 by Fiona Page. This has been Renee Ford Clark for GARS, the Georgia Radio Reading Service.